This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Tara McKelvey, is the author of the new book, Monstering, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. It's based on her interviews with former detainees who were interrogated in Abu Ghraib and other detention facilities run by the U.S. She also interviewed U.S. Army officers, soldiers, human rights lawyers, former administration officials, and private contractors. A sergeant who worked in Abu Ghraib gave her a DVD of films and photos of wild, druggy parties and sexual antics within Abu Ghraib. McKelvey thinks they show the semi-lawless culture at the prison that may have contributed to the climate of abuse. McKelvey is a senior editor at American Prospect and a research fellow at NYU School of Law's Center on Law and Security. She was the first American journalist to interview women who had been imprisoned in Abu Ghraib. She says some of the women were detained because they were considered a threat, but others were in Abu Ghraib because they had family members who were suspected insurgents.
There was a lot of sweeps going on in Iraq at the time. People would get, you know, caught up in house raids, or they would be captured in sort of group arrests. And some of them were brought in because they were family members, either the wives or sisters of some of the high-level people that they were trying to bring in. And they were put in prison and used as bait in order to get the people that they wanted to come forward.
How were they used as bait in prison?
For instance, I spoke to one woman whose brother was in the deck of cards, you know, the Pentagon deck of cards for the people that were on the most wanted list. And she was put in prison first as a way for people to ask her questions about where her brother was, and also as a way to say, you know, to him, we have her, come here, you know, come to our station, our police station, wherever we are, and we'll talk to you and we'll let her go.
One of the women who you interviewed, you used the name Selwa for her. Is that, mm-hmm. is that a pseudonym to protect her identity?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
She was arrested because her husband had been close to Saddam Hussein. What was his relationship to Saddam?
Actually, in the case of Selwa, there were accusations against her. An official with the Pentagon read me some passages from her report. She had been accused of providing material support to the enemy. I think it was they thought that she had been giving money to the insurgency. Her husband was a member of the government, like most of the people that I interviewed who were brought in. Many of them had some ties with the government.
What did she tell you about her treatment in prison?
The interview I did with her and with the other people who had been held at Abu Ghraib, I did these interviews in Amman, Jordan, and in a hotel room. They were brought over as part of a lawsuit. The interviews were very, very difficult. I knew when I went over there what my editors in New York and Washington wanted. They wanted me to come back with a story that said, you know, some cover line that said, I was raped at Abu Ghraib, you know, quoting these women. But I knew that these women would have a terrible time talking about what had happened to them, because if they were to say that they were sexually assaulted while they were in U.S. detention, their reputations would be ruined. They would be seen as, you know, as something horrible having happened to them. It's in some ways their fault, and they would never really be able to recover. So when I sat in a room with her and asked these questions, it was really, really hard. I could tell by some of the, you know, body language or by some of the ways that she reacted to the questions that terrible things had happened to her, but it was difficult to get her to talk about them.
What did she tell you?
She would tell me, for instance, about some of the punishments that they received while they were there. She was held in a detention facility in Tikrit, where there were hundreds of prisoners, and she was one of the few women who was there. And since she had been a high-ranking, you know, a very sort of, you know, fancy person in Iraq at the time, she had a nice house, her husband worked for the government, she wore beautiful clothes and jewelry. The things that happened to her were particularly difficult because she really valued her status. And in some ways, it was like a terrible irony that here this woman who had such power and status in the Ba'athist regime was then subjected to these, you know, humiliations at the hands of Americans. One of the things they did is they had these big cans that they used to put in human waste. And then they would pour gasoline in them and stir it up and burn up the human waste. And usually it was something that was done by the soldiers or boys who were working there. But in this case, one of the officers told Selwa that she was responsible for stirring up this enormous can of waste. She said she didn't want to do it. It was humiliating. And he went over to her and said that if she didn't do it, he would have one of the soldiers rape her. So she did it, and she described what it was like to stir with this enormous stick until she fainted in the hot sun.
And were you able to corroborate that story?
When I first heard it, I was like, "Why? What is she talking about? Like, what is this like big can, and what's this stick?" And then I talked to different people who had also, I talked to one person from a human rights organization who had interviewed former detainees, and he also described the same punishment that was used for the prisoners. And then also, I even found a photograph of one of the cans of the human waste that was used, and I found other descriptions of what this process was. And so then it didn't seem like something like just totally weird. It made sense to me. And as far as whether she was made to do that at the prison, I can't verify that because I don't have any witnesses who were there. And that was always a question in my mind about whether these people are telling the truth or not.
And do you feel like you believe her?
Of course. I mean, all of the people I talked to, I was very skeptical. They had plenty of reasons to lie to me. You know, I mean, they hated Americans in different ways. And there were, you know, good reasons for them to lie to us. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out whether these stories I heard were true or not. In the case of Selwa, I was there in Amman with a translator named Rania Kadri, who's really tough and great. And she's worked with all the American reporters who have come over. And Rania was very skeptical, too. She's like, well, they always lie, they always lie. And, you know, I said, well, let's go and hear her story. And by the end of the interview, and these interviews are long, they're not like normal journalism things, they're like several hours. At the very end, Rania Kadri came out and she's like, she's the real thing. She's telling the truth because she tells us things that she knows she shouldn't, which is, for instance, that she thinks Saddam Hussein was great and other stuff that would discredit her in some people's views. And then in addition, like in all the stories that I included in my book, I verified them as much as I could, as much as humanly possible. I would have backup evidence for what had happened. I would always determine from the Pentagon the dates of their detention and of the release and the places they were held. And as much as I could, I would have other people talk about what had happened to them while they were there.
What are some of the other things women told you about how they were treated?
They described some of the conditions at the prison at Abu Ghraib, how they lived in these cells. They were very close to where the high-level detainees were. The women were held in a place called Tier 1B. And Tier 1A was where most of the photographs were taken that, you know, we saw in April of 04. And the women there were held with children, and the cells were small. They had no place to wash themselves, and so they described washing out their nightgowns and then wearing them at the same time so they could try to stay clean but also have some dignity. And they also described what it was like to hear the children crying at night and to hear the children calling out for more food. And one woman described how she would, when the guard wasn't looking, she would toss out a banana or a piece of fruit to the children who were nearby so they would have something to eat.
Are these children who were imprisoned because they were suspected of attacking American troops? Why were the children imprisoned?
Some of them were accused of attacking American troops, certainly. Some of them were caught up in these sweeps. I interviewed one boy who was 16 when he was held at Abu Ghraib, and in the book I call him Fulani to protect his identity. And he told me about how he had been there for a few weeks, and he kept asking people, you know, why am I here? Tell me what, you know, what are the charges? And the only person he could talk to was the interpreter because nobody else spoke Arabic. And then finally one day the interpreter came to the place where he was being held with other juveniles and passed out these slips of paper. It was like kind of like a nightmare report card day where they would find out what the charges were. And Fulani got his charges and he's like, well, there's two pages and they're blank. There are no charges. And he showed the interpreter that there was nothing written down, and the interpreter grabbed the sheets of paper and wrote down something, you know, accused of shooting off rocket-propelled grenade at, you know, U.S. force or coalition forces, and then gave it back to Fulani. So there Fulani was with his accusations.
Now, that sounds to me like it could be a really fishy story.
Well, sure. I mean, if you think back, a lot of the detainee stories sound completely outlandish. I mean, there was a time, who would have thought, you know, a man stood on a box with a hood on his head, or that there would be some woman with a prisoner, naked prisoner on a leash? I mean, these stories are crazy. And that's been certainly a big part of the problem of telling the story about abuse that's taken place in Iraq. What people here need are, you know, verification at every level, and that's completely understandable. The problem is if you have an account of what happened in prison, and you need a photograph to go along with it. Making those two things come together is extremely difficult. In the case of Fulani, I spent hours with him when I was in Amman, Jordan. I met members of his family, his uncle, and they told me the story about the arrest and raid on his house, you know, where there was two people who were killed, including a 9-year-old boy. Arabic language television had filmed some of the attack on his house and the farm. So there was plenty of evidence around that to show that he was a reliable source.
I guess the other thing that must make it so hard to do this kind of reporting is you could argue that because we have the photos of Abu Ghraib and we know that there were abuses there, then we could take the most outlandish charge and say, well, that must be true, too, because look at what happened. But, of course, you can't do that. You can't say everything
sure.
must be true just because of the photos of
Abu
Ghraib.
Yeah, that's silly, and that's not fair to the people that I talk to, or it's not mm-hmm, fair to mm-hmm. the people that mm-hmm. that you know that this happened to. There was a very careful vetting process that I went through in order to find out which stories I wanted to include or which stories I could believe. I mean, at times I would lose my patience with people I was interviewing. Some of the people had agendas. They wanted to get money. Like, I remember one guy I interviewed gave me a list of things that had been confiscated in the raid in his house. And I'm just going through this list, and I just, it was like the end of the day, and I was really tired. I was just like, I am not going to help you get your machete back. You know, just these things that people wanted from me were just, you know, not right. I wasn't in a position to do that, nor did I want to. But on the other hand, some people had stories that were compelling and that I felt like really needed to be told.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tara McKelvey, and she's the senior editor of American Prospect and a research fellow at the NYU Law School Center on Law and Security. Her new book is called Monstering: Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. Now, you found that there were some precursors of those Abu Ghraib photos that Charles Grainer took. Would you describe what you learned about those earlier photos?
Well, the images, the photographs of Abu Ghraib that came out on April 20th, 2004, they were quite shocking and outlandish in many ways and obscene. But it turns out that there was stuff going on like this at the prison, in different parts of the prison, different times. And in addition, the stuff that happened in the pictures, it was not just that night that they took place. If you look back, for instance, at Charles Grainer and Linda England and at a history of their courtship, it goes back to the United States. And they met in Cressop Town, Maryland, and went away for a weekend to Virginia Beach with a friend of theirs. When they were there, you know, they got drunk, they partied, they did whatever, or they were drinking, and they took a bunch of pictures. They were quite obscene and quite lewd and quite graphic. And they included shots, for instance, of Linda England performing oral sex. You know, the photograph was taken by their friend. They also included photographs of Grainer taking, like, really, you know, moment-by-moment pictures of them engaged in various acts, of them two engaged in these acts. Now, later on, these photographs were almost reconstructed, you know, very, very similar depictions were taken at Abu Ghraib. And at Abu Ghraib, for instance, it was Linda England and Charles Grainer again, along with a friend of theirs, another friend who they asked to take pictures. Only in these pictures at Abu Ghraib, Linda England added a flourish, which was the thumbs-up sign.
Did you ask her how secretive they tried to be about the photos?
Linda England and Grainer, they were not secretive at all. It was very, very obvious what was going on. Luciana Spencer, one of the guards who was there, testified that there was a picture of the human pyramid on a screensaver in the isolation room. It was the worst-kept secret at Abu Ghraib that this stuff was happening. Plus, there were people hanging in their cells and screaming. Linda England described the screams that you could hear at night.
Now, you also got a CD of photos that, to my knowledge, have not been made public. How did you get these photos? And where were they taken?
I spent a lot of time with a man named Sam Provence, who was at Abu Ghraib during that time in the fall of 2003. And he sent me a CD that had these, you know, films from the, you know, party room at Abu Ghraib. And they showed a bunch of his friends, you know, who were soldiers and guards, kind of, you know, listening to Outkast, having a great time. And they were doing what he called robo-tripping, which is a cocktail made of Robitussin. You know, you take the bottle, you drink it down, and then you follow it up with Vivarin. And supposedly it has kind of like it's a little bit like LSD, you know, you're sort of tripping for a while. And they would put on this music and they would have these weird lights. And in some of the videos, they would act out sort of violent acts against pretend detainees. They would create something like a chair and turn it into a human dummy, and then they would start stabbing it. It was pretty disturbing when I saw it. I was just like, Jesus.
Now, you write in your book, Monstering, about Adel Nakla, who is also known as Abu Hamid. He is an Egyptian-American who worked as an interpreter at Abu Ghraib. He was a private contractor employed by the company Titan. And there was also a lawsuit against him that was thrown out because the district court in Washington, D.C. didn't have jurisdiction over him. But what did you speak to this interpreter directly?
I tried to talk to him. He shows up several times in government documents, in both the Taguba report and the Faye Jones reports, which are military investigations about what happened at Abu Ghraib. He also appears in photographs that were released in the set of photos for the Abu Ghraib during the Abu Ghraib scandal days.
What is he alleged to have done?
He's in the documents. It says, for instance, that he participated in some of the acts that might be interpreted as abusive. So, for instance, you know, he talks about this in one of the government documents where he says that, you know, he did ask them, some of the prisoners, if they were gay or if they enjoyed what was happening to them. And according to some of the documents, he might have helped adjust their bodies when they were lying in the prison naked close to each other.
Now, you interviewed one of the people who says he was interrogated by Nakla.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
What did this former prisoner of Abu Ghraib tell you?
The prisoner in my book, I call him Maya. It's a fake name to protect his identity. He described what it was like when Nakla and Grainer came to his cell and they had him put his hands behind his back and fastened his hands together, and then they held him, suspended him by his hands. This is what's known as a Palestinian hanging. And it's extremely painful because your body weight is being held by your arms behind your back. And he asked, he begged, he cried for them to take him out of the position, he says. But they kept him in that until eventually he fainted and found himself on the floor.
Nakla, the interrogator, was a private contractor. Were there different rules for interrogation by people in the military and people hired by private contractors?
The contractor who's in Iraq, certainly when Nakla was there, was operating in some sort of legal gray area. There are laws that could hold him accountable in the United States, but some of them, for instance, there's something called the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act that was passed in 2000 that supposedly would cover someone, or that does cover somebody, like somebody who's a contractor working in Iraq. But it's relatively untested. As far as I know, there's only been one case, and it did not involve a person accused of abusing a detainee. There's also the Patriot Act that was used in one case of a contractor in North Carolina. But there have been very few legal cases where these contractors have been prosecuted. And if you consider that, according to the U.S. military census of December 2006, there's 100,000 contractors operating in Iraq, and none have been prosecuted for any violent crimes.
What were the reasons why Nakla, the interrogator hired by a private military contractor, couldn't be held accountable for damages, and why his part of the case was thrown out?
Sure. And Nakla he was an interpreter. He was not an interrogator. And some people say that he really wasn't even supposed to be in that part of Abu Ghraib when he was there. I mean, he wasn't, apparently was not officially assigned to Tier 1A, but he hung out there, he had friends there, spent a lot of time, and became sort of the unofficial interpreter for that part of the prison. And there were all sorts of accusations against him that appeared in the government documents. But the investigation was, you know, in some ways very ambitious and aggressive at certain periods of time, but eventually seems to have gone nowhere. And at this point in time, he's not being prosecuted. He's basically, there's nothing that will happen to him at this point.
Is that because they didn't have enough evidence, or is that because of jurisdictional difficulties?
The civil suit was thrown out for jurisdictional issues. There are some critics of the administration who say that contractors have not been prosecuted aggressively because it has not been an interest of the Justice Department to do so. I mean, even the New York Times writes about how the Justice Department has been one of the government agencies who's been responsible for sort of crafting legal guidelines to practically indemnify CIA officers, for example, from legal liability, and so that they have not shown much interest in prosecuting contractors either.
What are some of the other methods of interrogation at Abu Ghraib that you learned about during the course of your interviews that you didn't know existed before?
Well, the things that I would see, there's, of course, the role of women in these interrogations. When I first heard about some of the techniques that were used by female interrogators, I was in Amman interviewing somebody who had been held near the Baghdad airport. And he told me this story about a female interrogator and how she had pretended to seduce him or did these sexual things to him. And it just all sounded so weird. I didn't even know what to do with it. I knew if I came back to the States and said, yeah, you know, there are these women and they're wearing G-strings, that my friends would be like, oh, you know, va 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 boom, I'd like to be interrogated like that. So I didn't even say anything about it. And then there were some disclosures from a book by a man named Eric Saar, and he described some of the sexual techniques that female interrogators or female military personnel were using at Guantanamo. And I just thought, whoa, that is the same stuff that this guy was telling me in Iraq, you know, and I started to look at it more carefully and found all sorts of examples and started to listen to the stories that people told me about the role of female interrogators.
Mm-hmm. And you also were told stories about, you know, sleep deprivation techniques that included playing music really loudly and also playing a tape of a child crying and screaming out. What was the child saying in this tape that was played as a tape loop over and over again?
Yeah, sometimes I thought that it was almost like 1984, when they would think of the worst thing that you could possibly imagine, and they would use that. But I think it was coincidence, you know, that when people told me the stories of their interrogations, they would describe the most horrific moment in that. And it wasn't as though the interrogators knew, because it just seems unlikely. But in that case, there was a man who was a sound engineer, who was a graduate of an art college in Baghdad, and he had three small children, and had built a generator in his house, and he described building the generator. When he was being held in the interrogation site, they did all sorts of different things, and that was the case where they used a female interrogator. And they also played a tape of a child's crying out, "Help me, Daddy, save me, please save me." And he described it, and that was the moment when he broke down and cried.
Was there a shortage of interpreters or interrogators at Abu Ghraib, and did that affect who was actually doing the work and how well trained they were?
Many of the techniques that were supposed to be used at Abu Ghraib had been tested at Guantanamo. At Guantanamo, the ratio of guard to prisoner, according to hearings on the Hill, was 1-1. At Abu Ghraib, the ratio of guard to prisoner was approximately 75-1. The techniques were in some ways, you know, questionable, but highly sophisticated and required certain conditions for them to be applied. None of those conditions were available at Abu Ghraib. The controlled conditions simply were not there.
What kind of controlled conditions are you referring to?
If you use, for example, dietary manipulation as a technique during interrogation, that requires that you monitor the diet, that you have a physician who's available. Whether or not you agree with that as a technique, there are certain requirements. They didn't have enough physicians at Abu Ghraib to help the people who were dying, let alone be a participant in a meal plan for a prisoner.
Do you know if the situation has changed in terms of the interrogation techniques that are being used now against Iraqis suspected of terrorism or participating in the insurgency?
I mean, one of the things that people need to be reminded of is that these interrogation techniques were designed really for these high-level al-Qaeda suspects, but they were applied to many people that had no information at all. 70-90% of the people who were held at Abu Ghraib, according to the International Committee of the Red Cross, along with multiple military sources, had no actionable intelligence. So as far as which techniques are being used against suspects in Iraq, again, it's difficult to say. The CIA guidelines are secret. You know, we're not privy to what's being used or even to who they're being used on.
Tara McKelvey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Tara McKelvey is the author of Monstering, Inside America's Policy of Secret Interrogations and Torture in the Terror War. If you missed something on Fresh Air or want to recommend an interview to a friend, you can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.